You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwanang, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. I'm interested in exploring how movies work. In The Eye of the Camera, William Rothman describes his writing as something that calls upon the reader to think about movies, which means, in part, thinking about the hold movies have over us. As I read them, Rothman says, these films are thinking. They are thinking about thinking. And they are thinking about film, meditating on the powers and limits of their medium. In What is Cinema? Andre Bazin says, thanks to the cinema and to the psychological properties of the screen, what is symbolic and abstract takes on the solid reality of a piece of ore. This hold that Rothman writes of, the resulting ore that Bazin notes, are the qualities of cinema that fascinate me. Theory offers explanations that transcend the single observation, experience, or example, says Marijke de Valk in her introduction to film festivals. Theories, she writes, are a set of ideas, not facts, that have been proven. To theorize means to suggest ideas about what is possibly true or real. De Valk describes the approach of Janet Harbord's essay as rooted in film studies and media archaeology, and I think that is also an apt way to describe my project. However, the focus for Harbord's essay, as the title suggests, is contingency, time, and event. She asserts that film visualizes time. It measures and makes manifest the time of viewing compared to other open-ended activities, such as reading or looking at a painting. What is historical, argues Harbord, is not film itself, but the act of viewing. The assembly of people before a film is a commitment to the now of viewing, to this moment, but it is only in the context of the film festival that this experience is framed in terms of an event. Today, films are available as segments to be downloaded, tailored to service the temporal needs of the viewer. Time is no longer experienced as units of duration, but a patchwork of activities, many of which will be overlapping. A film festival, on the contrary, gathers together the time of the film and the time of viewing. In so doing, it reinstitutionalizes the collective attention of film viewing. and recenters the time of projection as a live event, aliveness underscored by the discussions that follow. For time to register, she writes, something has to get away to escape control, the unforeseen obstruction of an object's path, the misfiring of an intention, and the automism of systems that have a non-human life of their own. All to function to undermine the planned order of the day and demonstrate to us that time is running uncontrollable and live. Festivals have captured and become efficient choreographers of the scandalous mishap that places us and itself in the moment of now. The festival model, she says, has built into its form a managed contingency whose function is to produce a moment of real time. It creates a moment that seems to paradoxically to suspend the moment to produce what George Kubler describes as the instant between the ticks of a watch. Actuality is, says Kubler, when the lighthouse is dark between flashes. It is the void interval slipping forever through time, the rupture between past and future, the gap at the poles of the revolving magnetic field, infinitesimally small, but ultimately real. In the early genre of actualities, contingency exploded onto the cinematic screen to reveal happenings, curiosities involving accidents and hazards, thus making contingency legible. Harbert observes that cinema later turned that excess into a feature of comic films where the capers of slapstick gesture became the accidental performed. She quotes Lisa Traher, who describes slapstick as a continuum of action that spans from physical violence to elemental decomposition to mechanical repetition to stylization. I think of the cinematic tradition of the pie in the face is the height of the stylization of that contingency. I would love to create a montage of pieing and culture to accompany the fascinating Wikipedia entry on its history. By recently showing my class how to use classroom films, I remembered my inclusion of a clip showing a pie landing on a man's face in extreme slow motion. Laughter ignited in the audiences of early cinema precisely because they were seated safely outside of the spectacle, for they were looking in on the scene that was already over. Harbert writes, in order for the Festival of Film to be a critical happening, an event in the year that matters, it needs to be a live event. And in order to demonstrate that liveness, its mechanical smoothness need moments of description. I recall seeing footage of TikTok of Julia Roberts disrupting a question and answer period by getting up and spontaneously bringing someone to the stage because of the t-shirt he was wearing. This was covered in various news outlets, including Global News and Yahoo, and it became a popular, singular moment to talk about what designates the festival as the container of that random, heart-stirring incident. These so-called spectacles produce a sense of the event running live, aliveness guaranteed by speech acts, misfiring, etc. Examining cinephilia as curation, film archives, and film festivals, Brendan Crudell says festivals represent circuits of films, money, and people, and the wiring of those circuits varies tremendously. Festivals are to cinema what journalism is to history. A first rough draft, a real-time effort to make some sense of cinemas of the world. By studying the history of film festivals, we gain insight into how cinema history comes to be. The Venice Film Festival of 1932 was the first film festival, and the idea of the Cannes Film Festival started in 1937 to develop a festival to challenge fascism, and it showed humanist films in 1946 after World War II. Monday. I just got an email from Trent University to notify me that I officially got funding to go to Hot Docs. I'm so glad that my risk paid off and I planned ahead of time. I could document my trip as much as I can put together something for a show on the Hot Docs Festival and the movies I get to see. It's a nice email. They thought about including this blurb in bold. The work you do is momentous, and donors recognize its value. They believe in you. Saturday. Sitting in bed at the hotel writing this, last night's feature, Another Body, was compelling. What sticks in my head are the filmmakers' question and answer period after the screening. Young filmmakers Ruben Hamlin and Sophie Compton seemed casual and unassuming for their international premiere at Hot Docs. The film is self-inscribed by its subject, Taylor, not her real name, but it was the filmmakers who prodded her to film the video diaries. The diaries were later edited together and painstakingly deep-faked through the documentary to show the sophistication of the very technology that enabled one to transfer Taylor's face to another person's body in a deep fake pornography online. From deep fakes, the self-documented vertical video diaries, and the use of video game aesthetic to reenact the past, it's a kind of film that could not have been made with such sophistication any earlier. The film faces the audience directly. Conversations on Zoom are cut back and forth from forward-facing shot and reverse shots, and the audience gets treated to the point of view of a video gamer navigating through documentary reenactments with rudimentary computer graphics. Influences from Haroon Faraki and to David Fincher torrent together in a compelling film about a hot topic that will open eyes through this convincing cinematic declaration about technology's state of the art. However, no time was spent on humanizing these perpetrators. Producer Elizabeth Woodward said it was part of their intention to present a composite character that was a kind of monstrous, sexed-up college everyman that points to the bigger problem of how these men get made and truly what motivates this kind of behavior. In 2023, boys will be boys no longer. Add deep fakes to snips and snails and puppy dog tails. Off screen, we hear about the supportive boyfriends, but never see them, deep faked or not. After the screening, the woman seated behind me said to her companion, "I already hate men. I didn't need to see something else to make me hate them even more." If it's a wake-up call, this film is the first flutter of the social eyelids. If, like filmmaker Sophie Compton said, revealing the identity of the perpetrators could inspire vigilantes, then their move to dehumanize the villain will only inspire us to look more squarely at ourselves, to see what we've become, a society that treats women as just another body. Harrowing, scary, and compelling to watch, it's unlike anything I've ever seen before, but I would like to see a second film made about the other side. Tuesday. Got back from Toronto. I may go back for tonight's screening of Invisible Beauty if I can postpone my dentist appointment. I will consider it and prioritize the film tonight and the conference talks. At yesterday's session on the big television broadcasters, the cultural shift was palpable. Po Si Teng of ABC News Studios addressed her colleagues' discomfort over their use of the word diversity. Both Leslie Burchard of CBC and Emma Hindley of BBC, white women both, mentioned their embarrassment. Although Hindley openly identifies as lesbian, Teng said she no longer uses the adjective diversity and said she preferred to say global majority. "I'm Chinese," she said. "The Chinese make up 1/5 of the world's population. 1 in 4 people are disabled." She went on with other statistics. There was a smattering of applause, and the other two panelists on stage went silent. I went ahead and postponed the dentist appointment and found a cheap condo for tonight with free parking. I can check in for 5 p.m. and still have the time to catch the 6:30 p.m. showing of Invisible Beauty. I think I want to take Georgia. She can drive down with me and stay overnight with me at the condo, and she can take the train back to Peterborough on her own tonight or tomorrow morning. My next Me Movie episode will have to be about the film festival and the festival films that I've seen that is relevant to the genre. I connected with the director of one of the films, Matthew Mueller, and he seemed eager to share himself and his work. I'm interested in film that feature the willingness of the filmmaker to have the effects of a hallucinogen on his state be documented. I did that once too, but I never had the courage to look at the footage. In the Q&A, Mueller admired that having the camera there was an impediment. I'm curious to know more specifics. I will have to tackle the cinematic notebook style as well and explain my thinking around the rough or unfinished nature of the web series. I want to do the next one after that on Wintopia and Rob's, my dad's tapes. I can get some footage of me in Toronto. A small crew produced the first-person film, Is There Anybody Out There? Director Ella Glendinning is also the subject of the film about her journey to find someone else in the world with the same kind of body as hers. Glendinning has a condition that limits her ability to function within the world designed for one standard body type, and consequently excludes others. Through the telling of her own story, documenting the people she meets, and research on pertinent archival material, Glendinning questions the current norms in an intelligent and compelling way. Why do so many prefer invasive, dangerous surgery for children over the use of a wheelchair? She models a way of dispensing information without the use of statistics, graphics, or medical names. During the Q&A at Hot Docs, a physician in the audience prodded Glendinning to name her condition. The director, seen on the same screen on which the film just played, through a remote connection, they projected a video of the director sitting in her bedroom. She said naming her condition was not relevant. Another well-meaning audience member spotted a guitar hanging in the background on her wall and asked if she would play a song. "No," she said emphatically. Maybe she inferred what I would have said if I was her. "Do you think I'm some kind of freak? Let me entertain you," she seemed to say. "Not." The film reminded me of Randy Cicchini's documentary on her medical condition, polycystic ovarian syndrome, of which, at the time, little was known. I remember having her be part of Techno Bondage, a multimedia group performance in 2001 that featured 9 television sets on stage, inspired by Nam June Paik. Chikini's condition gave her facial hair. She began her video with a shot of herself shaving. Thursday, home again after almost a week in Toronto, where I blew my savings on hotels and taxis. Thanks to the Trent University bursary, I will recover from this. I attended the Hot Docs Documentary Film Festival. I saw a few films and went on to as many conference events as I could. I'm a little burnt out now, and I've got a pile of laundry, but I'm sure I'll recover. I panicked when I couldn't find my green notebook. I called Tiff Bell Lightbox, and after being put on hold for a little while, the voice on the other end had good news. "I'm certain of it," she said. "They're holding it for you at the box office." I was at Paul's at the time. He was badly injured with a grinder at work just the day before. Just the memory of the picture I saw last night of the gash that curved on the right side of his neck makes my knees weak. It took 22 stitches on different layers of flesh to close him up. He was gauzed when I saw him. He came with me to retrieve the notebook. He seemed okay, except for whenever the car lurched forward. He severed a muscle. He's lost some functionality. He can't hold his head straight while getting up from lying down position without putting his hand on the back of his head. I drove to TBLB with him in the passenger seat. I jumped out of the car at King Street and John. I approached the box office and asked a woman if she knew where they had found it. She said no. "They just bring it down to the box office," she said. However, there was a yellow sticky note pasted on the front cover that said Cinema 4. I was in Cinema 4. I must have left it there after the Intimate Epics storytelling masterclass with Nicole Noonan, director of the film Crip Camp 2020, and Nancy Updike of the podcast This American Life. Part of me share in their joy of journalism. For me, coming out of high school, it was either journalism or film. At the time, it was between Carleton and York University. I chose York. Paul saw the notebook that I recovered from the lost and found when I got back in the car. My name and number printed in black on dark green. Visible, but hard to see. This is the second time I've lost an identical notebook. I originally got a 3-pack. I started the first notebook when the exam questions inboxed, and somehow I misplaced it before I could finalize my answers. I just tried to remember what I had written down. "What's the lesson here?" I asked. Paul said, "You're going to have to start putting stickers and doodles on your notebook to distinguish it, to make it stand out." He held up the notebook. "This is so plain, it's invisible." I drove him to Fiesta Farms on Christie between Bloor and DuPont, and there he grabbed the yogurt, meat, and apple cider that he liked. I like the title Intimate Epics. Is that what I write when I write stuff like this? Question: how do you know that you have a good idea for a piece? Noonan: I often approach a subject with geeky curiosity. If I have a lot of questions, then I know I have an idea. If it's taken a hold of me, if I say, "I can't not do this," it feels like falling in love. I start to see it everywhere. I scribble notes about it all the time. Research happens throughout the process. Updike says, "Bring in real questions and express real thoughts. for the story I was producing that asked the question, do UPS guys have sex on the job? I was more worried about not delivering any material to my editor. I chose the weird moment over not having tape to give him. When I heard that, I thought maybe I can spoof the Got Milk advertising campaign with Got Tape for a fun documentary community t-shirt. Everybody in the room seemed really into podcasts. I gotta compile a podcast demo. Overheard at the panel. Personal stories help us understand complex issues. We need these stories for hope and to remind us of our humanity. According to Noonan, Netflix was pushing for an alternate title for Crip Camp before agreeing to stream it. They said the title didn't work. They suggested calling the movie Judy and the Campers instead. In the talk called Crossing Docks, Crossing from Docks to Pods, podcast creator Connie Walker talked about the healing power of the podcast production process for the subject. Walker said, every time you tell your story, you're a little bit less broken. She said, the production gives the healing agency to the subject by allowing them to tell their own story. Then I can help to amplify it. Walker was joined on stage by Michelle Shepherd and Tanya Talaga. Friday. If I am to start a cinematic notebook, is there a way of showing its being in progress, unfinished and self-revising? Like it's a gathering of good or bad ideas, a blank page open to anything, how could a viewer know? Unless, of course, I document the notebook itself, the notebook might have to be a character and a way in for me to witness with the viewers the stream of presented images. So how to technically document the moment of my self-inscription on paper / on camera? The only thing I can think of to say is to do it over and over again, again and again and again. Keep trying. Don't try to get it right for the first time. Just try to get it done and redone to show multiple takes and retakes and expose the undone nature of the cinematic notebook. In Wim Wenders' 35mm notebook on Cities and Clothes from 1989, the leading lady is the video camera that he found less clunky, more invisible to the subjects, and more useful than its noisy counterpart. The film is a kind of ode to the new technology. This new freedom that was suddenly in the hands of filmmakers gave birth to a renaissance in cinema around that time and necessarily provided intimate audio visual recording access to private lives. The title of Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape from 1989 seems like a perfect headline for the times. Today I'll be speaking to Max Mueller. I met him at Hot Docs for the screening of his film Entities with Knowledge. Curiosity was my guiding principle, he said. I was very intentionally not trying to create a sort of master narrative around mushrooms. When I was filming with other people, I wanted a structured interaction where I was chatting with them in an informal way. And then I was working with them to choose what they wanted to highlight. So a lot of times it was sort of like pushing thoughts that I never would have thought of instead of time without talking to them. Ahead of time without talking to them. And what the film was about was happening as I was filming. Max Mueller at the Q&A at the Hot Docs world premiere on April 29th, 2023. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagachewinong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. And it's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, film theory meets film music. So I talked with Max Mueller, and I'm going to read from the transcript of that interview, that phone interview, and I may play some clips from the actual phone interview. During the interview, I asked him to tell me a little bit about the decision to place himself in the film and how that came about. And he said, I think there were a few things that factored in. I'd done some personal films before, and the film I'd done prior was also this, it was about the older couple, an older couple who were doing puppets, and they had this sort of puppetry theater company. And then I incorporated these phone calls between me and my partner into that sort of talking about our relationship and reflecting on that. And so, you know, I've done some personal filmmaking before. And in this case, you know, this was my thesis film at Stanford, and I was kind of drawn to psychedelics and mushrooms. And partially because I had some small experiences with them when I was younger, and they were really intense and kind of scared me off of them. But there was this sort of boon to reconsider them as a sort of cure for depression or a treatment for depression. And, you know, I struggled with depression forever. So I was like, okay, let me check this out. And I was really intending not to do a personal film. And I think as I burrowed deeper, you know, there was obviously the story with the main character, one of the main characters in the film base, who he encouraged me to do mushrooms because, you know, he does these high dose trips. And he was kind of saying, like, I think in order to understand this, you really have to do it. So I sort of considered that. But I was reluctant to do it just because it becomes very tangled when you're so close to the narrative. You know, you're sort of telling your own story. And it just raises all sorts of narrative questions. But it also, I think, from an ethical standpoint, it started to feel very appealing, just allowing the audience to understand and who is making the film, where the film is coming from. And from being more transparent around that, And then, you know, I was interested in filming somebody undergoing a potentially transformative experience. And that's a very vulnerable thing. And the person who I felt like most comfortable subjecting themselves to that was me. I sort of knew I could answer the tricky questions around, and it made a lot more ethical, straightforward sense. But I would like to say that the fact that it was also created all kinds of problems in me finding the narrative, basically, and having the distance to do that. You said at one point, I asked, that the camera was an impediment to your trip. Can you elaborate on that? And he answered, the cameras being there were certainly an impediment. I mean, what I had done is I had a psychedelic therapist there who was guiding me through the process. And it was very intentional, like a therapeutic process that I was undergoing. Then that person didn't want to be on camera. But we knew the cameras were going to be there, and we talked about it. In addition to just all of the kind of life stuff that I was working through, I was also working through this fact of being observed and wondering, like, why do I need the cameras here? Am I super self-centered? All this stuff that, like, you know, outside of the experience looking back, I don't think so. I don't think I'm actually, like, that self-interested. But just sort of the situation was that I felt so on display, and it created this whole kind of mess. But around that, it wasn't such an impediment that I couldn't do some really powerful work. And I think that was really important to just kind of move me forward to different points. The film and therapy on the day kind of coexisted, but didn't really support each other that well. And I was struck by the fact that, like, I wanted to, you know, bottle this sort of therapeutic experience. And there's a really difficult thing to actually capture, because, you know, once the camera's there, it tends to disrupt it.
Influenced by other video installation artists like Nam June Paik or things like that?
Yes. So I had seen there was this major retrospective of Nam June Paik at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and I went and saw it and was blown away. So that was definitely kind of in the back of my mind. And I kind of The way I think about all of that is I wanted to present a film that, you know, didn't so much have one clear message that it was saying about mushrooms, and more was kind of changing channels, almost like you were watching these different You were tuning into different stations, and on the different stations were different people who kind of had different orientations, different philosophies. And I also, you know, was interested in this idea of memory and the way that I am kind of revisiting these memories in my life to kind of work through a therapeutic process. And so I wanted to evoke this idea of, you know, this being an archive of experiences that I'm kind of working through. And then I think finally I'm sort of also evoking, the trip, that I went on, part of, I think, for me, what my depression manifested as is this difficulty in finding a clear meaning or finding a clear narrative around my own life that, you know, I had this sort of indistinct understanding of my own life or connection with my own life. And that process of finding kind of an emotional connection or a narrative that I went through in the mushroom trip is sort of similar in a way to the process of making a film, where you're trying to find this meaning and this narrative. And so I was in some ways trying to make that connection too, that that the filmmaking process is not super dissimilar in some ways to the process of undergoing this therapy. So that's kind of the sort of TV aesthetic of it. The other thing I guess that I was thinking about is I have a friend who does these video synthesizer I guess abstract video pieces. So I had been thinking of ways I could work with him for a long time, and it occurred to me that the trippiness of a mushroom trip is completely impossible to fully capture on film. So I needed kind of a shorthand for it, I guess. A linguistic move within the film to just say, like, this is, you are in the trip, this is what the trip is.
What are your thoughts? I wondered, like, just maybe it'll come when I ask you answer this question. Like,
sure.
What are your thoughts about the research creation process itself? Like, I know aside from curiosity, are there any other qualities you think a student of this kind of filmmaking could nurture? And in terms of that, was that part of your thesis? And did you have to kind of defend it with a piece of writing that kind of explained the process, or what was that like?
I didn't have to defend it with a piece of writing, which would have, I think that would have been good.
Oh, okay.
But I think for me, my process is primarily one of building relationships. That's important to me, is just sort of being open to meeting people, being extremely open to different possibilities of who could be in the film, what could happen in the film. Mm-hmm. And then taking my time before a camera enters the space. I think maybe to my detriment, I mean, I could put pressure on this, I'm sure, but I'm inclined to almost do anything, film anything that somebody who I'm filming with is interested in. So the situations that I'm filming in this film are all things that were suggested to me by the people I'm filming with, by and large. And, you know, I kind of do enough to set the stage so that I know that at the end of the day, some usable footage will come out at the end. But I also very much try to put myself in a position where I don't entirely know what's going to happen.
Right.
And I think because I don't think that would work with every kind of film, but because me as the filmmaker, I'm a character in the film, it allows for any kind of way that things sort of sway off one way or the other, that just becomes incorporated into the story, and that is just sort of another event that takes place in, you know, this character who happens to be me's life. And so that to me feels like a very comfortable position for me in relation to what I'm filming. I have a lot of respect for people who exert a lot of control over what they're filming. I think, you know, most films do, and I love you know, that kind of filmmaking. But for me, I just have a strong reluctance in my own filmmaking practice to have too heavy a hand with what I'm doing.
In the chapter Fostering Art, Adding Value, Cultivating Taste, Film Festivals as Sites of Cultural Legitimization, Marijke de Valk turns to Pierre Bourdieu's concept of symbolic capital to explain how festivals function as sites of cultural legitimization. Such theoretical frame, says the writer, can further our understanding of film festivals. Divided into three sections, the first, Field, deals with festivals' positions in what Bourdieu calls the field of cultural production and frames festivals as being rooted outside the mainstream commercial movie industries. The second section, Capital, elaborates on the process in which festivals confer value upon the films that screen. And then finally, Inhabitus, de Valk argues that film festivals not only provide cultural consecration, but also sustain the system of cultural legitimization at film festival by producing filmmakers that make films, especially for the festival circuit, and by cultivating the audiences that are interested and capable of consuming these works. I've been to countless film festivals, too many to name them all here. The virtual edition of Hot Docs 2020 stands out for me. I wrote about it in an essay. Cinema originated as a technical novelty at fairs and traveling expositions, a realm of popular arts and commercial culture. It is no wonder that the American movie grew to target a broad mass audience, and its universal stories, melodramas, and the message about an American dream not only enchanted its own domestic melting pot population, but proved popular across borders as well. In large-scale production, profitability of the product typically outweighs aesthetic considerations. Film festival screenings typically serve a cultural purpose, not an economic one. Festivals have additional sources of income, such as subsidies, sponsorships, and merchandise, and thus can program more autonomously than those cinema owners. Festivals offered a novel way to try and beat such American media imperialism by presenting cinema as art instead of commodity. Hollywood stardom is determined by popularity with audiences, on the other hand. Prestige is linked to appreciation by peers and experts from within the field. De Valk breaks down Bourdieu's distinctions between different types of capital. Economic capital, social capital, cultural capital, and symbolic capital. And economic capital refers to money, assets, and other economic resources. Social capital involves access to resources based on one's network and relationships. Cultural capital determines a person's social status in society, class, and is formed by knowledge, skills, education, attitudes, and taste. Symbolic capital, finally, points to the resources available to one on the basis of prestige, honor, and recognition. Because of such emphasis in selection criteria, film festivals are able to offer what is called cultural legitimization. Selection by a festival brings cultural recognition to the film and its makers, because it serves as a hallmark of quality. She quotes Wesley Strum, who argues that taste in high arts is mediated by experts, whereas taste in low art is not. Winning an award at the Cannes Film Festival, says De Valk, is the most prestigious honor a filmmaker can receive, which can, at times, be converted into economic capital, as was the case for Blue is the Warmest Color, which enjoyed wide theatrical distribution after winning the Palme d'Or in 2013. Laurel leaves are frequently used to advertise films on posters and trailers. They have become a stamp of artistic approval. De Valk writes that Bourdieu's notion of habitus is well suited to explain the dynamics between taste making and festivals. Habitus encompasses the way socialized norms influence individuals' behavior and thinking, what people believe to be common sense, the natural or necessary order and proceeding of things, is in fact a largely arbitrary set of arrangements held up by the beliefs and practices of people. Festivals thus are, in Bourdieu's words, part of a system for reproducing the producers of a determinate type of cultural goods and the consumer capable of consuming them. De Valk writes that filmmaker Apichatpong Wirsithekul is a good example of a filmmaker with a clear festival flavor. I like the way she describes his work as rooted in Thai regional culture and interlace its loose stories with autobiographical components and gently exposed political, can mobilize many like-minded people. Duvall quotes Bill Nichols, who maintains that an encounter with the unfamiliar, the experience of something strange, the discovery of new voices and visions serve as a major incitement for the festival goer. Film festivals have become unintentional archives. I want to mine as many as I can through publicly available resources or obtain special permissions. The discovery of new, to me, films is indeed a major incentive to keep reading about cinema. However, the job of obtaining the films on my list for viewing is one of the more daunting tasks ahead. You're listening to Synesthesia, produced live in the studio at Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF FM in beautiful Nagajiwinong, Peterborough, Ontario, every Thursday at 5 p.m. It's also a podcast on Soundproof, creative nonfiction for audio. I'm your producer and host, L.A. Alfonso. In this audio program, Film Theory meets Film Music. We've been listening to the work of Esmarine, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, and Daniela Pinto. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week.